This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the National Museum of Australia. It's actually lovely looking at the number of people here, just a few really good friends in the audience. Lovely to see some people back, familiar faces. Welcome on a Sunday afternoon. Nice place to come to on a Sunday afternoon. And welcome to this very special event. And before I introduce two people on the stage, what we customarily do, of course, here at the National Museum is to acknowledge that we are on Ngunnawal, Ngunnawal and the Ngambri land and pay our respects to their elders past, present and future, and to any other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who may be in the audience today. Very warm welcome. And a welcome to you. Thank you very much for coming. This is the third annual conversation, if you like, event for the Australian of the Year. You might recall, I don't know if any of you were here for the Rosie Batty conversation we had a couple of years ago, and then last year we had David Morrison here, the 2016 Australian of the Year, and of course this year we're delighted to have the 2017 Australian of the Year, and I'll see if I can get these words in the right order. So biomedical scientist Professor Emeritus Alan Mackay, Sim, who is our 2017 Australian of the Year, is about to be interviewed by Jane Hutchin of the ABC's One Plus One. Some of you may not realise it, but the cameras we've got, apologies if they're a little bit in your way, but they're actually being used to record the One Plus One programme. That's why we have so many cameras in the room today for this event. So the program was developed with our very good partners, the National Australia Day Council, and Kayla Scott from the Australia Day Council is in the audience. Welcome, Kayla. And it's a fantastic partnership project that we have with the National Australia Day Council. And this event has become a bit of a signature event throughout the year. And it heralds, if you like, the next stage of the process that starts all over again. So right now you'll probably be aware that the 2018 State and Territory nominations are taking place and those people are being selected, some of whom we already know, most of whom we already know now. And, of course, we will have an exhibition here at the end of the year opening on the 14th of December down in the hall, which will, again, as we did with Alan's, will have an object, a signature object, that each of these nominees or successful people choose to have in their exhibition, which tells us something about them. So you must come along once that exhibition's in place. From the 14th of December, it'll be here until February next year. I'd like to introduce briefly Jane Hutchin. She probably doesn't need any introduction to you because she's very well known and very loved by all of us. But Jane is joining us again. She was here last year for the David Morrison conversation. Jane, for those of you who don't know, was a correspondent, a foreign correspondent in China and the Middle East and London before returning to Australia to take up this extraordinary program that she's run. I don't know, Jane, how many people you've interviewed. Would it number in the...
350.
350. So, look, if there's anyone in the audience who hasn't been interviewed by Jane, I don't want you to feel you've been left out. But I haven't been. That's 350. Extraordinary. Now, that's not extraordinary. It's an extraordinary number, 350. Of course, a number of well-known people, but people from all walks of life on Jane's program, which is wonderful. And we are waiting in great anticipation for this conversation. And I'd like you to warmly welcome Jane Hutchin and Alan Mackay Sim.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this special In Conversation event at the National Museum of Australia with my guest, the Emeritus Professor Alan Mackay Sim, who is, of course, the 2017 Australian of the Year. It's lovely to see you. You must be super busy at the moment.
I have a full-time job.
Being Australian of the Year.
Being Australian of the Year, yes. It's been... I was adding up the number of trips I've made and five per week, I think, I've averaged over the whole year.
It must completely change your life. I guess when you're announced as the Australian of the Year, any plans you have for 2017 go out the window. Is that how it works?
Oh, completely. I had some idea talking to previous winners, thinking, Gosh, I don't think I'd like to do that.
Really? Because it's so intense?
Because it seemed to be so intense, but it's been fantastic, really.
You must travel the length and breadth of the country.
All the big cities, some, you know, some lots of times, and some regional cities, up to Darwin and the Bathurst Islands and Cairns and Tasmania. It's been fantastic.
And the message is to communicate the science as well as the award?
Oh, certainly. It gives me an opportunity to talk about the science, but it also gives me an opportunity to talk about the importance of science and the importance of particularly of biomedical research. And I talked to teachers. I had a really good occasion where I spoke to, at the School of Distance Education, talked to about 100 kids around Australia on the ends of their computers, you know, and it was just great, really engaging, and they love to hear about science.
Your research is ongoing, but your full-time job, I guess, if you can call it that, as head of a laboratory, that finished in 2015. So how does the research become ongoing?
Well, so I closed my lab and retired, but have this position at the university where I can continue to contribute to the university, and I have several collaborations with people inside and outside the university. So it's all done on the keyboard, on telephone and email and so on.
So when we hear the term emeritus professor, what does that mean?
It means that you've done well enough at your university for the university to think, okay, we'd like to keep a connection with this person, and you want to keep that connection. So it gives you, you know, access to the office and the email and all the resources of the university, and allows you to kind of continue your work into retirement, really.
We're going to go into your work and the whole world of stem cell research, which I've always found absolutely fascinating, in a moment. But I want to find out about the boy who was born in Roseville, northern suburbs of Sydney, some time ago. I think you're in your 60s now. Let's just leave it broad for all of our sakes. And you grew up the third of four boys. Your dad ran a series of hardware stores, I believe, and your mum had been a nurse. I'm just wondering where the science part came into your life and when.
Well, it really came from inside. I was curious about biology and really got curious about, strangely, just about how the body works is how I've always thought of it, you know, and how my own body worked, you know, because introspective thinking about, gee, how does my brain control my hand, you know, how does the heart pump blood around the body? It was just something that fascinated me.
Do you remember a particular time or a moment or a toy that you had that sort of took that interest a step further?
Well, yes. I don't know how much of this comes from telling and retelling of it, but the way I picture it was that, in the 50s when you're growing up and your mum's a nurse, if you get sick, basically you just go to bed, you know, and avoid everything. And so what boys did then was to put glue little plastic planes together and plastic cars and paint them. And my mum saw my interest in the body, and she brought me home this plastic model of a human, which had a plastic, clear plastic outside, and it had a skeleton and all the organs, and you could paint them all. And so in reassembling that, I was learning the names of the organs and the bones and everything. And I kind of think of that as my entry into beginning to understand what the body was.
I remember at school feeling that I was particularly bad at things like maths, and I remember thinking, you know, physics and chemistry were quite difficult for me as well, and I wondered whether at that stage I'd sort of given up on, you know, thankfully probably, a career in science. But I wondered, did you get that sort of opening encouragement throughout your time at school? I'm always fascinated by people's school experience.
Yeah, look, I don't really think of my primary school as being anything to stimulate me. But I went to high school and I just loved school. I just loved learning stuff. And so it was really a matter of not having anybody discouraging me then. I mean, I had the odd good teacher, but it was really, again, I just wanted to learn deeply about pretty much everything.
What was your first job in science?
My first job in science? It was, I was a student, an undergraduate student, and I worked in my professor's lab.
What kind of a lab was it?
I was measuring some hormones in some rat's blood.
And between that and the time where you made this sort of special connection, I suppose you'd call it, with the nose, were you always heading in that direction? You know, some of us get great ideas when we're young and we don't act on them. Was your own discovery like that, or, you know, did you have a pretty even stage of steps?
Well, if I could bore you with the steps, when I was at the end of my high school, I interested in how the body works and the brain works, and I wanted to put those together as an undergraduate, and so I did that at Macquarie University. And at the end of that, I wanted to get into sensory biology, and there happened to be somebody there who was working on the sense of smell, and that's really how I got into the sense of smell specifically. And and then after that, I decided I wanted to study the nose, the sense of the organ that gives us a sense of smell. And that was a choice because I thought there's nobody else in Australia who does that, and that will make me... You know, when you're a young scientist, you want to have some expertise that nobody else has that will make you somehow needed or wanted or in demand. So I decided on that. And I'm still the only person in Australia working on the sense of smell.
Do you think when you made that decision as a young scientist, did you get some people who might have thought that was either an odd or a kind of, oh, gosh, the nose, you know, of all things to study? Oh, did you get any of that pushback?
I think in general the nose is understudied and undervalued.
I agree.
And the history in Australia, the history has been, there's been a lot of really good research on, you know, seeing and hearing, but very little on smell. So it's always been kind of a curiosity to most other scientists.
It's true, isn't it? Mm. Because I actually have a lot of, I won't bore you about my nasal problems, but I have a few issues going on there. And I was having this game with my daughter once about, you know, if you didn't have one sense, which would it be? And I have to say, I picked smell. And then I sort of thought, oh, but then that would affect my taste. And, you know, I love good food. So, but, you know, a dog couldn't live without its sense of smell, could it?
No.
So why is it that we've almost kind of, I don't know, downplayed it? And we have such a lot of chemical fragrances these days as well. It's like you're being assaulted.
We don't downplay it. We spend billions of dollars around the world washing off one smell and putting on another smell, or putting smells into our dishwashing liquid. I got some dishwashing liquid the other day that was peppermint. And, I mean, this is so ridiculous because the sense of smell for most people is subliminal. We don't attend to it, but we know what we don't like.
Mm.
And most of us, the first response is we'll draw in something we like the smell of, and really push away what we don't like. So it's not an analytical sense. It's very much an emotion-driven sense.
That's really fascinating to hear that. So then you stumble on this wonderful organ, which, you know, none of us could do without, and it defines our faces, it defines so much about us. What was the area that you sort of... You knew, obviously, that the nose is... There's a pathway to the brain through the nose, but what about these stem cells that you've become, I suppose, well known for researching? How did you find that particular connection?
Again, that was happening very early on. My first research was, if you like, what the nose tells the brain. It was about trying to understand the electrical signals that go from the nose to the brain to interpret this sensory world. And then I learned that those sensory cells regenerate, or they die and regenerate. So there's very little mucus between the outside world and those cells, and then they're a direct connection to the brain. So bacteria and viruses can go straight through the nose into the brain. So we've evolved to drop those sensory cells if they get infected. So we have this whole defensive system there. And every creature that has a sense of smell, whether you're a snail or a crayfish or a fish or a mammal or a human...
Snails have a sense of smell.
They have a sense of smell. And they have this regeneration happening. And I thought, gee, that's an interesting biological question. Wow, how does that happen? And how do we maintain a sense of smell when we have this turnover? And that kind of set me off. You know, again, as a young scientist, you want to find an area of research that you think this is a really meaty subject I could spend a career on. Those are questions that you do have when you're in that position, rather than most people thinking, I'll just do this job and that job and this job. So you're thinking in a very long-term sense even then. So then the other aspect was that at the time it was thought this is the only part of the nervous system that can regenerate. So, couldn't you use that for something to regenerate the nervous system, the rest of the nervous system, the lessons you might learn there? So both of those things kind of led me to start down that path.
So the actual element of the research into stem cells, that wasn't your primary focus at first?
Well, back in the day, we didn't know how those cells regenerated. And the concept of stem cells, this is, let's say, the
80s?
The 80s. The main stem cells that were out there were the stem cells that are in our bone marrow that make our blood. So in biological terms, that was how you thought about stem cells. But we didn't know if there was a stem cell in the nose. We identified a stem cell in the nose ourselves and kind of said, well, that's probably like what's happening in the blood. So the stem cell idea has come into it later on.
What did it feel like when you realised that there were stem cells in your favourite organ that they could potentially be useful?
Well, again, it's really a matter of, the implication of stem cells wasn't there. It was that these are cells which would do the same job in this tissue as the bone marrow cells do in the bone marrow. You wouldn't get the same kind of excitement talking about a stem cell then as you do now.
Right.
Because it was just really a much more prosaic, here's a cell that must be giving rise to all the others to regenerate the sensory cells.
And before we leave stem cells and the nose, how do you actually extract nasal stem cells?
I say to my very good friend Chris Perry, who's an ENT surgeon, and he'll go in and he'll take the tissue comes from up in here, so it's all accessible through the nostril, and it's a very simple procedure, a very simple ENT procedure, taken out, worked on in the lab.
I guess a lot of the talk around the nasal stem cells that you isolated was related to, in particular, spinal cord injuries. But that wasn't the be-all and end-all of the research, was it? Those stem cells potentially have other applications.
Yeah, so there's a distinction here because although we take the cells out of the nose, the cells we put into the spinal cord are actually a support cell for the olfactory nerves. So there are the sensory cells which have to grow a nerve from the nose up to the brain to make the connection, and the supporting cells which assist that regeneration are the ones we put into the spinal cord. The stem cells are sitting in the tissue to make all of the cells there to regenerate the tissue. So, but we just grow them in a different kind of witch's brew of factors to get one cell type or the other.
Wow. So what kinds of potential were there from these stem cells? Tell us the kinds of things that they could potentially heal or regenerate.
Yes, well, we having taken them out, we thought we just did it. We kind of went into the sandpit and played around and, and I mean a play pit, you know, what can we make these into? And so in some, we could make them in a dish, we could make them into nerve cells, and we could make them into the support cells of the nervous system, as you might predict, but we could also make them into liver cells, and heart cells, muscle cells. We even did this fantastic experiment where we took them out of the nose in Brisbane, and we took them down to Adelaide, where they had a system where they could irradiate animals to destroy the bone marrow, and we put the cells in, and they made blood. They contributed to the blood of the animals who had a bone, like a bone marrow transplantation.
Wow! Did they have more success being turned into one thing than another?
It's hard to judge because it was really a matter of examples. We, you know, it wasn't any kind of competition. But we have put them into damaged intervertebral discs. You know, the discs between the bones of the spine, and they will regenerate the cells there appropriately. And we've put them into the brain of animals who have a movement disorder like Parkinson's disease, and they stop the movement disorder. So they're incredibly flexible in what they like to do, what they can do.
At one stage, you met the famous Hollywood actor Christopher Reeve while he was still alive, obviously, and when he came to visit Australia. Could you tell us what the conversation... Obviously, he had put a lot of money and effort into finding some kind of a cure for spinal injuries. What did you talk about?
Oh, we talked about the whole field and about where it might be going. So this was in 2003 and I think 2004, and I visited him also in New York in his home. So we discussed the personal issues of his own injury, and we also discussed the science, and we also discussed the implications. He wasn't going to subject himself to any particular therapy at that time, because if he did it, the implications, you know, had too many implications, I suppose. But he was really, really a great rallying point for fundraising and cohesion around spinal cord injury research in the US, and was a great force for bringing a lot of disparate fundraising organisations together under the one umbrella and being able to then have a much bigger program of research.
So where in your research did you get up to in terms of the application of those nasal stem cells and spinal injury recovery?
These olfactory and sheathing cells, these support cells, we showed that if you take them out of the adult nose and put them into the injured animal, they will regenerate their locomotor behaviour, their movement of their lower limbs. And then we did this clinical trial where we showed it was safe to take them out of people and grow them in the dish for 4 to 6 weeks and put them back in again. And so that demonstrated that it was very safe to do this, apart from the issues you're having major surgery. But the cells weren't doing any damage. And so that has led to this group in Poland with this one gentleman where he had received those cells after a stab wound and is now walking. And our work now at Griffith University is to start our own clinical trials in several years to further the work.
Why is it that, I mean, are there many other people apart from this Polish man who have been able to walk again as a result of this?
No, there's only been one human, but there have been thousands of animal experiments.
And why is it that there's only been one human?
Because it's...
What's it down to?
No, it's a good question. There are lots of animal studies, but the question is, and we know the cells work. It's very clear that they work. But how do you find the right group of humans that they're going to work in?
Ah.
So for example, when we did our safety trial, to reduce the risk, you go to people who are paraplegic, have an injury in their chest region. But injuries in chest regions are huge because you have to smash the chest in order to break the spine, so that you have a very big biological problem to solve. If you come up to this part of the body where the injuries are smaller, the downside risks are much higher. So there are all sorts of very difficult ethical and medical questions that arise. And then there's the question of what's the best time to put them in? Do you put them in fresh after an injury, or do you, wait till they're very kind of technical, ethical, medical questions that we've been vexing ourselves over for many years.
Really?
Yeah.
So did you perhaps hope that in your lifetime you would see many more successful transplantations?
I'm not dead yet.
I know. That's why I say in your many years to come.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm really pushing that we can go forward with this and start to look at patients who will benefit, rather than just think about whether it's safe.
Because there's so much hope invested in a spinal cord injury, isn't there? And I suppose the length of time it's been since people have had those injuries, and I know a few people who have injuries, and their hope is just incredible. You just sort of think, I'd never want to blow that for you,
No. But no, I mean, when we first started this many years ago, it was a concept of we don't want to give people false hope. But on the other hand, all of the developments, all of the experiments that have been done in injured animals with these cells really have the proof that the spinal cord can regenerate in animals. And the first proof. So up until, let's say, the year 2000, you'd say, no, there's no hope. But now I think there is hope. Whether it can be translated for an individual is the other question, But I really think that the spinal cord can be regenerated, and it's a matter of finding the right conditions that might be so.
What about the cures for other illnesses and other applications for stem cells? We've been hearing for many, many years that, diseases like Parkinson's and so forth are, on the verge of making breakthroughs. Mm. Is that hope that is possible within your lifetime?
Yeah, look, I think that the first concept of use of stem cells was to make cells or tissues for transplantation. And right early on, there were cells for diabetes and cells for Parkinson's disease. And they're still going. I think there are some now the first trials coming for Parkinson's disease. And with diabetes, they've finally worked out how to make the beta cells to make the insulin. Yeah. But then you have the problem of how do you put them in so that the immune system doesn't attack them. So there are all sorts of technical problems. And as for making whole organs for transplantation, that's way down the track. So really, I was really interested in that at first. And then I thought, no, I'd rather go somewhere where we can get more quickly into the clinic. And that would be to use the stem cells from patients and from healthy controls, and compare them to try and understand a biological difference. So in cancer, you look at a cancer cell, a skin cell, and a normal skin cell, and you say, what's the biological difference? And then you use that biological difference to find a drug to kill the cell. Whereas this concept is you look for the biological difference and you try and find a drug to treat the cell. And that's really now probably the a very strong theme now in stem cell research, and it's what my main theme in stem cell research now is for brain diseases like schizophrenia, Parkinson's disease, some motor neuron diseases.
So are you saying the use of transplanting stem cells?
Not transplanting, no. So it's really much more about the basic biology. So
the biological difference of the cells.
The biological differences.
Right.
Can we find out, let's say these are from this patient group, how do they differ from the healthy controls? And understanding what's going wrong in those cells, could you find a drug to treat them? And with one of the diseases that we're looking at, a rare disease called hereditary spastic paraplegia, we've gone from taking the patient's cells and we now have a drug to take into patients as a result of that. So it's a different way of finding new treatments, but through the stem cells and through the stem cells of the nose.
Wow.
Yeah.
Am I right in saying that you yourself, some years ago, when you were not very well, received stem cells?
I did.
Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, well, I have a disease, a leukemia called multiple myeloma. And in the leukemias, when you get a bone marrow transplant, now it's called a stem cell transplant because we understand what the biology is.
What was in the marrow.
What was in the marrow. But it's bone marrow transplants have been around for about 50 years. But it's interesting. I mean, the stem cells are given because you get such a huge hit of chemotherapy that it kills all of your own stem cells. And so that if you don't get the stem cells, you die. So the stem cells are used there to rescue you from the chemotherapy.
I see. So it's not the same kind of thing as enabling a spine,
no,
tissue,
not a,
spinal tissue
no,
to regenerate.
No. It's kind of like rebooting your whole blood and immune system from the transplanted cells.
Apart from the fact that you were probably quite sick as all that was going on, that must have been quite mind-blowing as a scientist, you know, even understanding what you knew, that injection of stem cells was
well,
saving.
Look, I, you know, you're still a patient and you're still reacting as a patient and as a person who's in a very life-threatening situation throughout all of that. But I was very fortunate that my oncologist and I had this great relationship where all the way through the process we were talking as kind of scientists on one hand, and then when I needed it we were talking as patient doctor, you know, and I guess I was terribly engaged with the whole biology as it was happening to me.
Did it give you a kind of different insight into treating patients, being a patient yourself?
It really gave me an insight into the importance of that doctor-patient relationship. I think, you know, you understand that person is being a professional, right? But you know as a patient that you're absolutely dependent on that professionalism and that, you know, even if it's kind of professional empathy, if you like, you know how much you need it. It was interesting in all sorts of levels, actually.
Yeah. Are you well now? Do you have a good prognosis?
Oh, myeloma is a disease which becomes chronic. So you relapse and you remit and you go onto different drugs, and at some point the drugs don't work. You know, it's
always with you.
It's always with you. Yeah, yeah.
Does that give you a sense of urgency in your
it does actually
in your work and
it
your
does.
Life?
It does. Yeah, yeah. You. It's not just something like a, you know, I don't know, a heart attack which you might get over, because it's there all the time. I mean, we're all going to die, aren't we? But it gives us it does give a sense of urgency, and it really drives my sense. The science I'm doing, I really want to push some of these things I'm interested in.
Gives you a great sense of purpose, I guess.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
When you were interviewed in January, very soon after you were announced as the 2017 Australian of the Year, you spoke about the desire to have a conversation with Australia, in a sense, a public conversation about building a scientific infrastructure in Australia in the long term, and also the idea of how to give young people a career in biomedical science again in the long term. Why is this such an issue at the moment?
I think that it's important. What I've learned this year is it's not only politicians who don't understand the long-term need in science, you know. So I can tell my story of this kind of long-term interest, but any science, any biomedical project requires commitment for many years, and I think that trying to get that message across to the general populace that these are people, this is an enterprise that has to have this long-term view. In a small way, I've been able to, you know, in the audiences I've had, have been able to let people know that. I think politicians, I understand now, they do gather that, they do realise that, but the situation in which they find themselves is that they aren't going to support it unless it has the short-term consequences for elections.
Right. That must be very frustrating.
But I think intellectually, when you talk to them, they, you know...
Of course, they agree.
They know.
It's a great idea to have a cure for this and that.
So
how would you rate your success in somehow making this a public conversation?
Oh, that's very difficult. I think that you have a success at the individual level. So, you know, I've been to so many activities, and it's been school kids, it's been people in the street, it's been teachers, training, it's been Rotary clubs, it's been corporate boards. And so you're getting this view out there across, whether people take it in, you don't know, but at least, you know, it's like sending out ripples, I suppose. I don't know how you measure it, really.
Because I know at one stage when you were out there looking for funding for your own research work, I don't know whether this is because I just happened to see the right article about this, but I think it was Tony Abbott at the time who saw your work, and I think he liked this in particular because it was adult stem cells as opposed to the much more controversial area of embryonic stem cells. How dependent is scientific research on catching the eye of an influential politician?
I think it's played a great role. It happened with the embryonic stem cell research. They were extremely well funded at the time as well. And then I guess the politics allowed them to fund adult stem cell research. So there's both those kind of direct political donations to institutions in all sorts of around Australia, as well as the competitive rounds of funding that happen through the National Health and Medical Research Council, for example. But philanthropy plays a great role.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because I think there's an expectation as we go forward that philanthropy should play a bigger part in a lot of those bigger funding institutions than government. I mean, how do you get the message out to philanthropists, and is it as popular to give to a long-term scientific project where there might not be a very certain outcome again in a short space of time?
So I think there's philanthropy, there's the kind of big box philanthropy where people will give a lot of money for a particular centre, and that's something that I think is gradually developing among the rich and corporate end of town. But there's a huge amount of philanthropy happening with cancer councils and smaller groups which actually play a very important role, because they're willing to fund more risky research, they're willing to fund younger people, whereas the government agency like the National Health and Medical Research Council, by nature of the beast, tends to fund good, really good, but conservative science. So Whereas the charity, they're just focusing on their disease, and they can fund new ideas, inject new ideas. So there's a mix there that I think is an important driver in all sorts of ways.
You're going to come to an end of your 2017 term as Australian of the Year. What excites you going into the future?
Oh, look, it's still the science we're doing. It's the spinal cord injury repair. It's really driving to get this clinical trial for this hereditary spastic paraplegia.
What's stopping that? Is it money?
It will be money, but at the moment it's planning. It's just getting it planned and going. The the spinal cord injury work, we've just been funded well from the state government, the Queensland government, and so we're looking for matching funds, you know, to, because these things are very expensive. I've also been thinking and trying to work out a way to get some kind of commercial driver into this clinical work, into this clinical trials funding. Could we place a value on the savings, the future health cost savings, let's say to insurance companies for spinal cord injury, and could we use that health, that savings later to drive investment now?
Wow, it sounds like a great idea.
It sounds like a great idea, and I'm talking to all sorts of people. It's, I think, extremely difficult to pull off, but I'd like to find another way rather than just to go cap in hand. It'd be great if we could find some kind of inherent driver for it.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful idea to me. And ladies and gentlemen, before we move to questions, and actually I might just sort of say that bit again for television. I don't think they're using the questions bit. But ladies and gentlemen, I hope you'll join me in thanking Emeritus Professor Alan Mackay-Sim. It's been fascinating. Thank you. Thank you so much. But we're not finished there, because you do have a chance now to ask Professor Mackay-Sim some questions. I just find it mind-boggling, you know, the potential, and also with my limited science brain, was all knocked out of me. But, you know, I'm sure there must be some questions that you have here. Can we maybe bring up some house lights and... There we go. And we have a question. We might give you a microphone if you can just wait for 2 seconds. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Mackay-Sim, for a fascinating talk today. I was just wondering whether there are any other areas of the body which give rise to adult stem cells and sources of research.
Any tissue that... Any part of you that regenerates has a stem cell. So in our all of our tissues... The job of the stem cell, I mean, it's obviously what the skin does, you know, it protects, seals up, has hairs in it and so on, the differentiated cells. But when you cut yourself, it's not those cells which divide and become more skin cells. It's a stem cell that sits there, and it usually is often doing nothing until stimulated, and then it just buds off and makes lots and lots of cells which go on to repair the tissue. So in muscle, in skin, in the gut, virtually every tissue has some stem cells in it.
Thank you. Hi, Alan. This is sort of going back to the biology of what you're doing. You mentioned that it was the support cells that support the nerve cell regeneration. Are these support cells the sheath cells that surround a nerve cell, and are these sheath cells on all our nerve cells in the
yes.
in the body?
Yes. So every nerve cell has some kind of cell that's wrapped around it, and they go by different names. So in the nose, they're called olfactory ensheathing cells. You know, it's just whoever named them. In the peripheral nervous system of the nerves going out to, they're called Schwann cells, and in the brain and the central nervous system, they're called oligodendrocytes, and there's another one called a glial astrocyte. So each of them is slightly different. The Schwann cells that protect the peripheral nerves, they will allow regeneration. So if somebody has they cut their nerves, the nerves will grow into those and re-innovate, and you can get back touch and so on. The cells of the nose, people said, well, maybe because they're allowing regeneration of the nerve fibres from the nose to the brain continually, and because they actually go into the nervous system to allow the nerves to get into the nervous system. So that's what first suggested to people that they might be useful for putting in the spinal cord, because they could live inside the nervous system and they would also make a path for the regenerating nerves.
Amazing. And this lady in the orange, thank you.
I know there's research being done in North America and Europe to help people who've had their turbinates surgically damaged. Do those, and I know the stem cell research being done about to repair that damage, I wonder if those people know about your work.
I have no idea.
Okay.
So the turbinates are the inside the nose. There are these very light curls of bone, like a bit like this, that upon which all of the epithelium is, and the sensory cells are located on them. And they're often taken out if you have polyps and nasty infections in the nose.
I've had a septoplasty and turbinatectomy. I have one of 20% of people who now have empty nose syndrome. It's awful. I would love to know if those people in Europe know what you have done.
Unfortunately, although the tissue regenerates, we don't know how to repair it itself in any circumstances when it's lost. So it's one of those terrible conundrums. We just don't know how to get that repair back at the moment.
This gentleman here.
Alan, Dean Beaumont.
Hi, Dean.
Hi. A question. Animals have a vomeronasal organ as well as an olfactory system, and we as foeti have that. Has the olfactory system taken over the role because it's no longer there for us other than a few pits? Do you know the answer to that one?
No. In most animals, the vomeronasal system as you know, it's a separate sensory organ that has a lot of similarities and goes to the structure and so on of the olfactory organ, but it's usually used for either signalling prey, detecting prey, or detecting members of the opposite sex and directing sexual behaviour. But we just don't have it. There is some evidence with humans that we are detecting members of the opposite sex. So people can, if you wear a T-shirt and women wear T-shirts and men wear T-shirts overnight and they give them to men and women the next day, they can tell who wore which T-shirt. So we can detect members of the opposite sex, but whether or not we use that greatly, but in the same way that animals would use their vomeronasal organ, I don't know.
Right in here, Luke, in front of you.
Alan, that was a great talk so far. I'm just wondering, what do you tell people who say, I've lost my sense of smell?
Yeah. It's very difficult as I was saying before, that for most losses of sense of smell, whether it's through surgical loss or whether it's through traumatic injury, we don't know how to put it back. We don't know how to repair it. And with Parkinson's disease and with Alzheimer's disease, it's a loss of smell which seems to precede those diseases. And again, we don't know whether that lies in the nose or whether it lies in the rest of the brain as those other diseases are lying in the rest of the brain. So it's really much a matter of counselling. I mean, we really can't do anything about it.
Because a friend of mine in Germany said, if you lose your sense of smell and you take out an insurance, they're apparently regarded as more than likely having a major issue. But I'm not sure if that happens in Australia.
I know that compensation for loss of sense of smell, in the kind of accident compensation, it's very little. You don't get much. It's not regarded as being a great impairment. Although, if you're a chef or you're a winemaker or just somebody who loves food, it's a huge impairment.
I'm interested to find out whether expertise in the nose today around the world, has it picked up from the time when you first started to research the wonders of this organ?
No, I don't think so. I think that, the inevitable increase in the number of people in a scientific field, yes, but not greatly. Most of the research around the world is probably done by food and drug companies and perfume companies. So there's a lot on that sensory evaluation side of things. But there's not a lot of people still who are working on the sense of smell. And I think part of it is it's so hard to study. It's hard to define an odour, hard to give an odour, hard to... And it turns out that the way that we... biologically we detect odours, although now we have a deep sense of how that occurs, it's still extremely difficult to study at a biological sense. But we've got about... let me think. In mice, it's about, let's say, 10% of the genes of the mouse are given over to sensory detection in the nose.
Wow.
So it's very complex, and it still remains very complex.
And what about humans? What percent are we?
So we have about 600 genes that are involved in our sense of smell. Out of about 1,000, we each have slightly different combinations. Mm. And we have about 20,000 genes that we use. So,
amazing. Yeah. Sorry, anyone else have a question? Probably got time for one more after this.
Hi, Alan. Just a question. The sheathing cells you described, which side of the blood-brain barrier do they derive their nutrients?
Both, because they live in the nose, so that's outside the blood-brain barrier, and then they penetrate and take the nerve fibres from the nose into the brain itself. So they're on that side as well.
So they're the interface between the brain and
that was why they were one of the reasons why they were thought they might be good candidates for repairing. The spinal cord, because the cells, these Schwann cells that come out of nerves that you could grow if you take a piece of nerve out, they stop. They won't go into the brain, whereas these will pass into the brain. And the first experiments were done to try and reconnect spinal nerves that were cut, and they found that if a spinal nerve was cut, as you might, let's say if you rip an arm or something, you could move the brachial plexus and the spinal nerves coming into the spine, but if you sew them back together and inject these cells in there, then the sensory cells can grow. Sensory nerve fibers will grow into the spinal cord. So it's this being able to live in both parts is one of their great attributes.
Any more questions? Last chance. Here we go.
As a fellow high school student of yours many, many years ago, I just wonder if you wanted to comment or offer some insights into the value of the education process that you went through in terms of contributing to your brilliant career. Robert Cussell.
Oh, hello. So we went to North Sydney Boys High School. I think it was a great school. I think that... I have no concept of what high schools are like now, but we had a great education, I thought, and we had really good teachers in general. I don't know what other insight I can give except that we're all full of... Being a selective school, I think, you know, lots of people where it wasn't shameful to do well, shall we say. I think so... And there's probably, because we're all boys, there's probably heaps of competition and so on. So everyone was competing against each other within that in that system. So, but I think the value was the value was the effort that the teachers put into us and the interest in us and our academic advancement.
And that's all we have time for in this In Conversation with the 2017 Australian of the Year, Professor Alan Mackay-Sim. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.